Check.
So I'm sure there were people who would have, if they agreed to that, would want a cap, and it was at $15 originally, and then it was raised to $25.
So there's enough confidence out there that, number one, it has to be, and number two, that they are getting enough benefit from it that you're not sensing in your membership any concern or...
Actually, as part of the membership dues, we have the client security fund assessment in there. So really, yearly, the membership approves. The board has presented that to the membership for approval. So while I think technically the board might not have to do that, it has. And the membership has approved the $25. And really, the $25 has only been in effect, I think, for 2 years before that. I think it was 13, and then before that, it was even down to $3. Problem is, we've just had a fair number of recent claims, and the amount of money that that generated wasn't enough to make for a viable client security fund.
Any other questions?
Senator Hamby.
Madam Chair, may I ask the witness to go back to Section 5? In your printed testimony, you have in your second paragraph there in your explanation, the Supreme Court suggested that the statute may impose a duty on lawyers beyond that which is imposed by the bar's disciplinary rules. Could you give me an explicit example?
Senator Hambly, when you read the statute, it just says that lawyers shall maintain inviolate the confidences and secrets of a client. The disciplinary rule already spells out, and as an attachment to the memo is the text. And the problem is the statute is very categorical, and it seems to suggest that there are no exceptions. The problem is our disciplinary rules provide for a number of exceptions, so that you could make an argument that the statute being in existence, even though you have the disciplinary rule, you don't get the benefit of the exceptions. And that just doesn't seem right, as you have two potentially inconsistent standards on the same issue or the same concept.
Madam Chair.
Sure, Roger.
Pursue this further, because I'm not sure I understand. The disciplinary rules now are both in statute and in rule, is that?
No.
The disciplinary rules are adopted pursuant to authority vested in the Board of Governors and the Supreme Court and the membership. So it's not, it's rulemaking authority. It's ORS 9.490, which just provides that if the Board of Governors adopts and the membership approves and the Supreme Court approves, then the disciplinary rules are binding on all members of the Oregon State Bar. And so that's how these disciplinary rules, such as 4-101, have been adopted.
What is the statutory confidentiality requirement that will remain in place after this?
The attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, that, okay. I'm going to, Senator Shoemaker, I've asked, yeah. Bill just pulled that out, and it's ORS 40.225, and we can get it copied or we can pass it over to you about what will be in place and what isn't touched by this.
Okay.
I don't know. Bill, do you want to?
Sure, I'll get a copy of
that. I might also mention that this statute, 9.460, is referenced in another section of the Bar Act, which says that if you violate this statute, you can be disciplined. Of course, you can also be disciplined for violation of any of the disciplinary rules. So really, this is a disciplinary-type statute as opposed to really dealing with the contours and parameters of the attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, we're going to get that copied right now so we can pass it out to the person.
Okay.
Back to it for detail. Senator Bunn.
Madam Chair, I hope this isn't an answer, or maybe it will be answered by getting the photocopies, but what you've said, I think, is that the Supreme Court has said our statute as it is written now that you're proposing to change may give more protection to the client than is necessary or than was intended. If you determine the exceptions, where are the limits to how many exceptions you can make?
drawing them.
Well, and I guess that's what, maybe we'll find that the other section of statute will state what the exceptions are.
The limits are, and currently in the statute, I think it's 9.490, is there is a process for the adoption of disciplinary rules that apply to members of the Oregon State Bar. Those have to be promulgated by the Board of Governors, approved by the membership, and adopted by the Supreme Court. So you have three tiers of approval before additional disciplinary sanctions can be approved.
That's not really what we're not interested. Okay. I think what I hear Senator Bunn saying is what we're really looking at the outside limits of what are the exceptions to confidentiality, and we're going to what are the limitations of breaches of confidentiality that will be in statute. And I guess I think we're going to find them in 40 here in a moment. But okay, if they're not there, we'll want to visit this in the next few minutes and come back to.
Yeah, I guess that's the concern, that if they're not in 40 or it's fairly vague, but we are potentially giving you the authority to exempt virtually anything or everything, there may be a long procedure for you to go through. But I question whether or not we want to put ourselves in a position now of giving away those protections that may or may not be our responsibility.
We'll come back to it in a few minutes and we'll get it. Thanks, Finch.
Okay, next is Section 7, also dealing with the Client Security Fund, and it allows the Client Security Fund to pursue recovery of money paid out of the Client Security Fund not only against the dishonest lawyer but also against anyone else that might be the cause, although not directly involved with the actual taking of the money, would have been responsible for it. For instance, a partner or an associate in a firm who was aware of what was going on, didn't participate in it, but would be by legal standards negligently responsible for what occurred, or some layperson who was involved with the lawyer in the process of aided and benefited from the money that was dishonestly taken by the lawyer, the fund could then pursue that person to try and recover the money. Sections 8, 9, and 10, and this has to do with what we call a trust account or overdraft notification rule. This is a fairly new concept that has been adopted by a number of other states, which requires notification to be given to the bar if one of its members overdrafts their trust account, and the idea of it is to give us, hopefully, a head start, maybe a warning of some other problem that's going to come along that will then end up being a claim against the Client Security Fund. Idaho has such a plan in existence now. The Supreme Court of Washington just adopted one, will be in effect in March. California is looking at it and probably will in the near future. This requires obviously some effort or some action by the bank if adopted. And we've been working with the Banking Association, their lobbyists and their lawyers, to work out some wrinkles in this bill. And we would ask that any hearings on this be postponed and held until we can work a little longer with them, and we think shortly we'll be able to come up with some legislation that will satisfy what we're trying to do, that is give some additional protection to the public against somebody that's going to take money from a trust account, but which will be workable with the banks. They've got some problems with their existing computer program that we need to work out. So if that's what we'd like to do is come back to you with a change in that.
We appreciate that.
And then last is sections 11, 12, and 13, which is a proposes a rule that simply requires that if a lawyer is going to incorporate, he or she will necessarily have to incorporate under the Professional Corporations Act. There are some lawyers presently incorporating under the Business Corporations Act. Most lawyers incorporating under the Professional Corporations Act, and there are different rules and requirements, and we feel that they all lawyers ought to be, if they're going to incorporate, ought to be under the same law and working according to the same rules, and that's why we're proposing this legislation.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shoemaker.
It also would permit lawyers to incorporate as a nonprofit corporation. Could you explain the reasons for that?
Senator Shoemaker, I think that comes up in the context of legal aid and public defender offices. We didn't feel that they had to be PCs, but that anyone in private practice not in that area would be required to.
How about the liability of a partner in a nonprofit corporation to clients of that nonprofit corporation? In other words, does the nonprofit corporation law provide a protection against liability as a business corporation law does?
I'd have to check that. I'd be happy to.
If not, I'm concerned. It seems to me that a nonprofit law corporation ought to bear the same responsibility toward its clients as any ordinary law firm does.
We can check that. And, of course, as I understand it, the those attorneys are required to have professional liability coverage, but it's not necessarily through the Professional Liability Fund. It's through the National, I think, Legal Aid and Public Defenders Association, but still they do have malpractice coverage for their activities. But I think we can certainly check your
point.
We'll
get back to you on that.
Okay.
Okay, that's another flag we need to check out.
One comment that I have going back to the attorney client privilege issue. If you look at the last page of our memo, I think I can answer the question. Under DR 4101A.
I'm going to stop you and say, which question?
The question on the attorney-client privilege, the change in ORS 9.467.3.
That was one that Senator Bunn's concerned. He wants to sort of talk a little more.
I was going to point you to the last page of our memo, and DR 4-101A says, confidence refers to information protected by the attorney-client privilege under applicable law. So whatever is established in ORS 40.225 as the proper parameters of the attorney-client privilege becomes the standard here. Now, of course, we do get into the issue of what are the appropriate exceptions, but when you look at the exceptions, we talk about the client consenting. That's pretty straightforward. Where a court might order you to reveal something, and that is only after the court determines that this isn't a confidence or a secret. So you have judicial involvement. The next one is a client's intention to commit a crime, and actually Oregon's rule is quite a bit more permissive than most states in requiring or permitting lawyers to reveal criminal activity. A lot of states require that it be a certain type of crime where serious harm might occur to a client. And then the last one is also pretty much modeled after the ABA standard. It talks about where you might be defending yourself against a claim by a client. And in that case, there may be a waiver of the privilege and that sort of thing. So I think these are well-established exceptions, and it does key back into the parameters of the attorney-client privilege. And this, our disciplinary process, the statute authorizing us to adopt those rules, doesn't give us authority to change 40.225.
Okay, but we could still step in and decide to put these exceptions to the disciplinary rule in statute explicitly if we chose to do so, probably. And I guess I want to ask.
In fact, that was a logical question. When earlier you stated that you don't anticipate any changes, there's an assurance to us not to worry about it, I think. In fact, if there are no anticipated changes, mightn't it be safer to bring us into compliance in the statute with what your rules read now? I look at the one section, and it seems to be a much clearer protection for the client than the language in 40.225. I guess I'd like to ask a question on that, and it may be very simple, and I just don't understand it. But in dealing with a client's protection, it says a client has a privilege to refuse to disclose and to prevent any. Does that put the burden upon the client to prevent? Is it automatic that it can't be disclosed unless there's permission, or under statute, does a client have to exercise that right to prevent disclosure? Not based upon your rule, but based on statute.
No, I think the statute would, the lawyer cannot breach the confidence.
Okay, so the word, the client has the ability to prevent means that the lawyer cannot disclose, not that the client may prevent that if they choose to act.
I think that's just an added feature where the client could also attempt to prevent in anticipation of maybe a lawyer just recklessly or even intentionally deciding to violate the privilege. So you might get a court order to prevent the lawyer from doing that. And that, you know, that's possible, I guess, even though I think a lawyer in that situation would be certainly subject to disciplinary investigation at the very least.
Just one other comment, and again, we are dealing with discipline rules for lawyers, and most of the rules for disciplining of lawyers, in fact, almost all of them, are like Rule 4101, recommended by the Board of Governors, adopted by the Board, and then approved by the Supreme Court. So this is not something unusual that we're just taking this section out and saying we want to have the authority in this area. We're just saying this is a disciplinary rule that should be consistent, and it is covered, we think, already by the disciplinary rule.
Is there any difficulty from the bar's point of view of taking your rule and trying to apply it to statute as amendment rather than simply removing the section? Wouldn't that meet the need for consistency?
Well, I think we could certainly study that, whether or not putting these exceptions into the privilege would coordinate this, but I'd like to think that through.
I would say that I think this is the first of many we're going to be involved in this committee with respect to the confidentiality issues. There are a number of them that we flagged me and from around other just all sorts of areas that are that confidentiality questions are ones that I see surfacing here in the bills that I've read and looked at. So it is important, I think, that Judiciary Committee members get a grasp on careful reading of the privileges of various types, whether they be medical privileges or lawyer privileges. I think we need to think about the sometimes reverse way these things are written in statute. So,
Madam Chair.
It has nothing to do. I just sort of want to put an overall umbrella to say that this discussion, while it may seem more in depth than you all would characterize it, I think we all in this committee need to get some basic understanding because we're going to be delving more into the confidentiality from what I see things coming through. Sir Schumacher.
It might be well to put on the record, since we're having this discussion about the role of ethics rules on a lawyer's duty to maintain the confidences of a client. And maybe you could speak to that. I mean, if a lawyer discloses the confidences of a client, he is not only subject to discipline, but he's also violated an ethical rule that applies to him, which could lead, can that lead to liability? It
certainly
can certainly lead to disciplining and disbarment and those things.
Right.
But it's a sort of a set of almost laws that apply to lawyers in the conduct of their affairs.
Lawyers are fiduciaries, and I think you'd certainly have a good case to make that if the lawyer breached the privilege, that the client would have a cause of action for that, separate and apart from the fact that the lawyer may be disciplined by the bar and have a sanction imposed for that. So that's, I guess, where I see the kind of the separateness of the attorney-client privilege issue. If the lawyer breaches the privilege, the client may have a claim and be able to successfully recover damages for that breach. But also we have these separate rules having to do with discipline. And I guess we were trying to make sure that the disciplinary standard was consistent and not create a problem under the civil law in the privilege area. So I think we can take a look at that.
Anything else?
Chair, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For sections 3 and 4, your testimony says that fitness means more than someone is honest, and I understand about mental health. But financial responsibility for someone who's trying to be admitted, what are you trying to get there?
Well, in the statute, Senator Hill, is a definition of good moral character. Mm-hmm. And I guess we're trying to address more than just good moral character or honesty. And it's, I guess, kind of a number of factors. Financial responsibility, I think, if you had someone who was a kind of a scufflaw, they didn't pay their bills, they ignored their financial responsibilities to, let's say, educational institutions, or really a multitude of things, and if that would reflect
child support
on them, to the extent that they would not be handling their clients' money properly when they're admitted to practice law, okay, that I think that would be a factor that the bar could consider in deciding whether this person should be admitted.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, and let's see, when you say respect for the law and an appreciation of the rights of others, what are you trying to get at there?
Well, respect for the law. From time to time, we have had lawyers, involved in civil disobedience where, let's say they go to a nuclear reservation and trespass.
Yeah.
If they intentionally violate the law, is there an explanation? Or some more serious thing, drug possession. Lots of people in the course of their experiences may get into trouble, and we have a very thorough process to determine whether those law violations justify or warrant not allowing them to be members of the bar. I guess that's the best way to try to articulate the respect law.
Let's follow up on this then, because if you're talking about someone who is demonstrating, and we've had people now demonstrating for a number of things, if they're arrested or if they participate in civil disobedience?
I think we're talking about convictions here.
Okay.
Well,
if you do engage in civil disobedience, you decide that it's more important to advocate nuclear disarmament than violating the law on trespass. I guess you've made that choice, but then the bar has to evaluate, are you a person that is going to be living and abiding by the law? Because that's what lawyers do every day. They interpret and apply and make sure that people stay within the law.
And let me talk about, there's a number of things, but I mean, if someone was in some type of a civil rights demonstration, since this is Dr. King's week of his, are those the kind of things that you're talking about?
Sure.
I think someone's private life and their civil activities is not something that the bar would be concerned about. If you get into some types of criminal conduct which result in a conviction, I think the bar has a right to review that. Now, that doesn't mean that it's going to be disqualifying, but at least a careful examination of that is made. And I think that's what we're talking about as far as, fitness to practice. And we have a number of Oregon Supreme Court cases that really apply this. I certainly could provide that to Bill Taylor and maybe provide you with some examples of how this is applied. But We're trying to make the statute consistent with, I think, the standard that's used, and that's the purpose behind the change.
And this, an appreciation of the rights of others, what is that?
Well, I think Mr. Spickerman had mentioned the fact that, well, like child support or something, where you might, we did have a case not too many years ago where a lawyer just refused to abide by, well, an applicant refused to abide by a judicial order to pay spousal and, I think, child support.
Yeah, I know. That's under, well, I would say, isn't that financial responsibility? Because you, the courts have ordered you, that's when he mentioned it, was under financial responsibility. I'm talking now, when I hear things of appreciation of the rights of others, now I understand about child support. What is appreciation of the rights of others? Mean.
Well, let's for an example, if you are a lawyer, and let's say you decide to just take it upon yourself to harass people by filing frivolous lawsuits, I mean, you're affecting the rights of others. You're requiring them to expend money to defend against baseless allegations, and we want to make sure that people aren't of that orientation and aren't oblivious to the responsibilities that they owe to others to make sure that what they pursue are legitimate and in good faith.
Are you? What is? You're talking about an applicant here.
Yes. Well, we're looking at qualifications to become a member of the bar.
So you're talking about someone who hires an attorney,
right,
to file a frivolous lawsuit.
Well, some, you know, if someone has an orientation that is it seeks to ignore the law. I mean, the lawyer has a great responsibility and a fiduciary duty, and we want to make sure that the people that are in that position are respectful of the rights of others.
I would think he would be talking about someone who was filing a pro per on their own, making claims not through a lawyer.
Well, I'm talking about once you become a member of the bar. We don't want people that have that orientation that now that they have a license, they can do what they will to damage others without good faith basis for doing so.
Well, I guess, I think I understand what you're saying, but this is, if someone's filing frivolous lawsuits or hiring someone, and so would you just, you would look at each case and decide whether they have gone over a certain limit or whether...
That, along with a lot of other things, this would be one of the requirements that would be looked at in addition to the others that are already in the rule.
Well, I have to say it seems somewhat broad. When I see things like respect for the law, appreciation of the rights of others, and these kind of things, I don't know. It just seems very, it just seems very, very broad. And I guess I'm trying to look for some specific examples of what you're getting at here. And maybe if you have some cases of, you know, your actual cases that you've had to give some idea of what you're trying to get at, maybe I'd feel more comfortable. But anyway, I mean, because I figure if someone is convicted of any kind of a crime, then obviously that's something that you look at. But when I have some visions here of somebody who's involved in some kind of civil disobedience, or some kind of a protest or something, I'm just a little unclear as to what the line is here. Anyway, that's...
I just would make one observation that it is up to the Supreme Court to decide ultimately to admit people. So the Board of Bar Examiners is making a recommendation. And, I mean, I think there are safeguards here. The bar has no political or ideological litmus test for applicants. And I want to make that clear, that we're talking about what we're looking for in good lawyers and competent and honest lawyers and the credentials that need to be presented to justify giving someone the license to practice law. And so that's the orientation here. And I can provide Mr. Taylor with some case law, just some recent examples of how this standard has been applied.
Okay.
where actually people who have had some problems in the past have been admitted based on the Supreme Court's review of these types of situations.
Thank you.
The more you answered, the more concerned I was, actually, in dealing with these questions of the rights of others. You talked about the person who chose to break the law, whether it's a nuclear protester, an anti-abortion protester, a civil rights protester. Don't you end up with a very dangerous subjective area where you may be in one case saying, well, they were standing up for somebody else's rights, so that's justified? Or in another case, if you disagree with their position, mightn't there be a tendency to say they were walking on someone else's rights because of that protest? You know, we all have causes we believe in, and it's hard, I think, to say that person who was standing up for my point of view was walking on somebody's rights. But it's very easy to say someone who was protesting the opposite view, well, they were walking on the other person's rights. Doesn't subjectivity become a difficult thing to deal with in that?
Yes, it does, as does the existing law that requires that they be of good moral character. We're talking about
Opposed to anybody else what happened. In other words, if the first lien holder and the borrower get together and agree that the interest rate will be reduced from 12% to 10%, and I should emphasize, by the way, that's the usual way these things work. You got a borrower can't pay at 12, you can be pretty sure they're not going to be able to pay at 15, and you're not doing anybody any good by increasing the rate. It's usually a reduction. In any event, they reach an agreement to reduce the interest rate. There is no provision to tell anybody else other than the borrower and the lender that that has been done.
But the borrower knows.
The borrower knows.
Madam Chair, well, right now with the status quo, obviously the bill can be good for the borrower and is definitely good for the first mortgage holder. But dealing with the second mortgage holder, now if I hold the second mortgage, I'm guaranteed that if this disclaimer isn't included, I know the conditions of that mortgage that's got to be satisfied first, and then my mortgage is dealt with. But under this provision, if we adopt this, as far as the rest of the world or the second mortgage holder, if I have a second mortgage, I have no control at that point, do I? Because you could then actually change the balance due under the first mortgage, and even though I've filed my second mortgage, I'm helpless to deal with that. I made a second mortgage contingent upon understanding the first, but you're telling me the interest rate, the terms, the length, all of those can be changed on the first mortgage, and I'm now subject to that.
That's correct, and I should specify, and I've been discussing this matter with representatives of the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association, and I want to make sure the committee knows. This bar bill was proposed last summer. It was publicized. It was circulated. We assumed that all interested parties were aware of what was going on. This morning, the Oregon Mortgage Bankers Association raised exactly the point you raised right there. And I am, and the Oregon Bar will be dealing with that group. We've got some ideas about some things which can be done to protect everybody, and we may be able to reach a solution. That said, I do have a couple of specific responses to your point. The first is that I think that most people who haven't read the entire Oregon Revised Statutes and aren't familiar with the presence of this bill assume that that kind of renegotiation is a possibility. And if they take a second mortgage, they assume that, in fact, they're subject to renegotiation of the first. Second, the kinds of changes involved here are relatively small. The only one which actually affects the position of the second mortgage holder would be an increase in the interest rate, because in that situation there may be the second mortgage is subject to both or subordinate to both the principal and the interest on the first lien. If the interest rate goes up, that increases the amount that the second lien is subordinate to. If the interest rate goes down, the second lien holder is in fact improved in their position. It doesn't harm them. as far as the extension of the loan goes,
But the extension piece you can do already based on current law because it only applies to A through C, which is.
Pardon me. When I say extension here, what I mean is the adding the payments to the end of the loan. And that result can be accomplished under current law simply by, instead of signing a deal which says we're going to do this, the first lien holder simply holds off on foreclosing for 6 months instead of adding 6 months payments to the end. Those payments, that interest would have accrued anyway, and under current law, the second lien holder is subordinate to that. So I don't think that, in fact, affects the second lien holder. The execution of new notes, which is subsection 3, that's the other part, I guess I'm at a loss to see how that affects the second lien holder, whether it's this note or that note. It's just a change in the piece of paper. It's the terms that matter, and the terms would be things like the interest rate, when the payments are due, and so on. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't, well, the third point is that when the this bill would apply only prospectively. Existing mortgages would be governed by ORS 86095 as it exists. For people who make loans in the future, either first or second liens, after the effective date, if this bill is enacted, they will be aware of what the law is, and they will know what the ground rules they're playing under. And as long as everybody knows what the ground rules are, I think that everybody's in a position to decide whether to make the loan or not. As I said, we're going to be dealing with the Mortgage Bankers Association and, of course, anybody else who has an interest in the issue. We've got some ideas that may accommodate all the interests we're involved here. We could still facilitate workouts and at the same time protect second lien holders. So what we intend to do, and I have to say I'm not familiar with the procedures in front of the legislature, and I've just discussed this with representatives. What we would like to do is have some time to work with the interested parties, come up to a compromise which covers all the interests, and then put it back in front of the legislature.
That's really basically how we work on it. It's the value of hearings. Is that finally people kind of get the real attention directed.
Right, finally focused.
Got their attention
and that's
the day
okay.
of the hearings.
We expect that. Certainly, at least I do. Some people don't, but I do. On every single bill we have, there's always something that people didn't quite. And we also, it's a good practice to leave things rest for a week or so to let people who didn't even make it today kind of take a look at it again, and so we'll have an opportunity, and I've asked Bill to sort of draft a little explicit language with respect to effective dates that outlines the specific kinds of things we're talking about on the effective dates, which I would ask you all, both sides of this, to kind of get together with Bill and work on that piece as well.
To make sure I understand that you're talking about language to add to this bill to make clear that it is prospective.
Yes,
only.
and we use the right not just that we actually define what prospective
makes sense.
Instruments are.
Okay. Makes sense.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. Anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 405? Given those caveats. Okay, let's move to the last item on the agenda, and two more items. Oh, excuse me.
Something on the next page.
Yeah. We need to copy on the other page, on the back of the page. And then I would say, while we're at the pause, getting ready for Senator Shoemaker and Bill Taylor to sort of tell us about the Senate Bill 374. I think 374 was one that.
Yes.
That,
you want me to
Bob was
take
it.
The witness stand or do it from?
No,
do you
can
have
do
any
it
preference?
Here. I would say that reminder to folks: we are invited to the Bar Governor's reception from 5 to 7 tonight at the Willamette Alumni Club. So those of you who don't have it on your calendar, tonight is the night, isn't it?
I don't think so.
Tomorrow night.
No. Tomorrow night, Wednesday night. Oh, Okay, it is tomorrow night. Excuse me.
Something else.
Tomorrow night.
Still don't have it on my calendar.
Thursday night. Yes, do 5 to 7. Okay. Thank you. Senator Shoemaker, on Senate Bill 374.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. This is really a correction of an oversight in the last session. In this Nonprofit Corporation Act was before this committee in the last section. This section was amended substantially as we are now proposing in the committee, but somehow it got dropped when it came to the floor. I didn't catch it, and so it was passed without a clarifying amendment. So this is to correct that. And it is to make clear the exposure of a director of a nonprofit corporation to liability. The current language, if you read it carefully, is not clear in my view. And this cleans it up. Would now provide that the civil liability of a qualified director for the performance or non-performance of his or her duties shall be limited to gross negligence or intentional misconduct. That's the substance
of the bill, and that's what we're looking at here. Okay.
And I'd like to make a little legislative history regarding the meaning of one of those words, and that is the word intentional. What is meant by intentional misconduct? I would suggest that it mean a state of mind about the consequences of an act or omission, and not about the act itself, and extends not only to having in mind a purpose or desire to bring about given consequences, but also to having in mind a belief or knowledge that the given consequences are likely to result from the act, and that this state of mind exists when the act occurs. What I just read into the record is substantially a quotation from Prosser and Keaton on torts regarding the meaning of intentional when used in this context.
Any further amplifications, questions, comments?
Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Okay.
I guess we...
Do we have a copy of that in writing, or won't that be shared with us?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's in our...
I think it's in your jacket. Here.
I believe everyone received a letter that I addressed to Senator Shoemaker on January 8th, 1990, and it's the last paragraph on the second page, second to last paragraph, excuse me.
With one change, you'll see in the margin, I use the word likely rather than substantially certain.
Okay. Let's go ahead then and move to Senate Bill 396. Do we have bill introductions? None. Okay.
No work session on that.
Wendell, you're up on 396. We'll do it in a minute or two. Let's just. Dick is still reading.
Just didn't want it passed.
No. We'll. Senate Bill 396.
Members of the committee, on this bill, I'm speaking on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's Uniform State Laws Committee, also the debtor-creditor section, and the business law section. The bill is sponsored by
and,
the...
And you need to give your name for the record, please, Wendell.
Pardon me, I'm Wendell Kusneris.
Right, thank you.
The bill is sponsored by the Uniform State Laws Committee and the debtor-creditor section. It's supported by the business laws section, which is not a sponsor. What this bill does is repeal ORS Chapter 76, which is a part of the Uniform Commercial Code, the Bulk Sales Act is what it's generally called. This repeal was initially recommended by the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, which is the nationwide organization that sponsors uniform state laws such as Uniform Commercial Code in the first place. So this is the group which drafted Uniform Commercial Code, now recommending repeal of Article 6, the Bulk Sales Act. I should add that the American Law Institute has recently also endorsed repeal of the Bulk Sales Act. American Law Institute is a nationwide organization of lawyers dedicated to improvement of the law. With that background, the Bulk Sales Act, you need to know a little bit about that. Principally, what it provides is that if there is a sale of a business, and only certain kinds of businesses, a business which sells inventory from stock, it applies also in Oregon. There's a non-uniform amendment to sales of restaurants. If there's a sale of a covered business, the parties are required to send notice of that sale to all of the creditors of the seller. So if I own a business and I'm going to sell it to somebody, and I owe money to a number of different people who sell me inventory, might sell me my widgets, all of those people get notified that I'm about to sell my business. This has to be done 10 days or has to be mailed 10 days prior to the closing of the sale. The idea is that the creditors then find out that, I'm going out of business, I'm selling out, that they'd better take action to make sure they get paid. That's the theory. There are three basic reasons why repeal is being recommended. Let me go back and tell you one other thing. If the notice is not sent as required under the existing Bulk Sales Act, a creditor of the seller can avoid the sale. What that means is that they can come in for a period of 6 months and get a judgment against the seller and execute on the goods in the hands of the purchaser. So if I sell goods to somebody else over here and I don't pay my creditors can go and take the goods out of the hands of the purchaser here, even though the purchaser has already paid me. Obviously, this is a very draconian remedy because, in effect, this person pays for goods they never get. And not as a result of anything they did other than failure to send this notice, because they didn't incur the debts. They had no obligation to pay the debts. So, reasons for repeal. First and foremost, the Bulk Sales Act is a major burden on the sales of business. It means that, first of all, if you're going to sell your business, you basically have no choice but to have a lawyer who spends thousands of dollars probably making sure you comply with the Bulk Sales Act. You have to obtain a list of all of the seller's creditors. You have to send the notice. And you have to make sure that it's complied with exactly correctly, because under the existing act, anything short of perfect compliance is exactly the same as no compliance at all. If you miss even one creditor who's owed a small amount, any creditor of the seller can avoid the entire sale, even somebody who actually got notice themselves. So you have to spend the time and spend the money, if you want to be protected, protect against that. In essence, it's a lot of red tape. I should add that the burdens are so great that it's a routine matter and just a matter of common knowledge in the bar that parties to sales transactions just ignore the act. they decide to take their chances. It's even reached the point where you find judicial opinions stating that everybody knows the Bulk Sales Act is commonly ignored, simply to avoid the expense of complying with it. The second point is that the Act actually provides very little protection for the creditors of the seller. That's who it's supposed to protect. It's supposed to provide them with an opportunity to find out that the sale is going through. But the only protection they get is 10 days notice that there's a sale. Of course, it's mailed 10 days in advance. They might get it 7 or 8 days prior to the transaction. And all they have now is knowledge that it's about to happen. If they want to do anything, what they've got to do is hire a lawyer, file a lawsuit, try and enjoin the sale, or get provisional process. This is a difficult and an expensive process to go through, and you've only got perhaps a week to do it. So the long and the short of it is that the creditors who are supposed to benefit from this actually get very little benefit. So you have large costs and little benefit. The third point is the creditors of the seller have much better and cheaper ways of protecting themselves under existing law. The Bulk Sales Act was first enacted in the early part of the 20th century. Goes back to the Panic of 1893, I think it was, when apparently people routinely sold their businesses and didn't pay their creditors. The problem at that time was that it was not possible for a inventory seller to take a purchase money security interest in their inventory. That's no longer the case. Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code now means that for the price of a Stevens Nest security agreement, a UCC 1A, a lien search, and a first-class letter to a bank, you can obtain a lien on your customer's inventory, which will have priority over existing bank liens on it, and now you have something that really will protect you. If the goods are sold, if the business is sold, your lien remains on the goods. The buyer won't even buy the business because they'll do a lien search and they'll find out you've got a lien and they'll make sure you get paid. They'll have to do that. So the existence of a purchase money security interest provides the sellers, creditors, with far better protection and far cheaper protection than you can ever get under the Bulk Sales Act. In addition, at the time these acts were enacted, were first devised, credit reports were just not available. Now they're readily available, they're inexpensive, they're accurate, they're reliable, and you can find out whether you're selling and just not sell to somebody who's not a good credit risk. Finally, as I said, the consequences of failing to comply with the Bulk Sales Act are draconian, or in making a mistake. As I said, the entire transaction can be avoided, and this is particularly a problem in the case where the seller files bankruptcy. In that case, the trustee in bankruptcy can avoid the entire sale based on a failure to comply with the Bulk Sales Act. In summary, I guess what I'd say is that if the legislature were to enact a tax saying there's going to be a $2,000 or a $5,000 tax on every sale of a business in Oregon, that would be very unpopular. If it were added that that tax was to be paid to lawyers and they would keep it, I think that would clinch the matter. But that is in effect what the Bulk Sale Act is. It says that either you got to pay thousands of dollars to a lawyer to close your deal, or you've got to take a terrible chance of paying twice for what you get. And we don't think that that kind of provision makes sense when there is a cheap, easy, and effective alternative means for protecting the class that this is intended to protect.
Are there any questions?
Just a quick matter. How many states have repealed these?
No state has repealed. This is a 1989 recommendation of the commissioners, and it has not been enacted in any state.
Well, we do have actually listed as possible work session 374 and 396. If you all, we can do them today, or we'll put them on a Friday if you want to have a chance to sort of contemplate some more. But we can either do them now or do them on Friday, and as we sort of move ahead with some of the others. So generally, it's our policy generally not to have work session on the same day unless it's very, very simple. Just to give people, as we said, an opportunity to come in with last minute, whatever it is. And so if we want to have a work session on Friday on the ones that are ready to go, we can do that. If that's the case, we'll stand adjourned until Friday at 1. Thank you.
Madam Chair, has this been circulated enough so that there's no opposition to this?
I can't say that. It's certainly been publicized inside the state of Oregon. The bar puts in its bar bulletin that this is being done. It was announced at CLE, continuing legal education sessions, and so on. I can't tell you whether the people who might be interested in opposing this have found out or not.
Madam Chair.
Thanks. Senator Shoemaker.
Maybe I wasn't listening closely enough. Did you make it clear what the alternative is that protects the creditor?
The purchase money security interest in the inventory, which they can take under existing Article 9 of the UCC.
But unsecured creditors are at least some risk of the sale of a business when they're relying on the credit of the owner of the business. They may not know that it was sold until later.
That's correct. I mean, what I am suggesting is your alternative is not to extend unsecured credit. Your alternative is to extend secured credit when you go into the deal, and that is very easy to do under Article 9.
Okay. Anything else to come before us today? We'll see you all tomorrow, then, between 5 and 7. Thank you very much.
Thanks.